And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Over a barrel, a group of gun owners in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, gathered to protest the Canadian government's assault-style weapons buyback program. They say they're being unfairly punished and that the program will not prevent gun violence.
And a wing and a scare. The screenwriter behind a cult movie inspired by the myth of a tall, winged creature visits the small West Virginia town where it all began and tells us what it was like to come face-to-face with fans of the Mothman.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. The city of Nevis hosts an Oktoberfest celebration on Saturday, October 4th from 3 to 8 p.m. with German food, music, games, and more. Visit nevischamber.com for more information. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Paul Weller, who you might know from The Jam and Style Council, from his new album, Find El Dorado. This is his cover of Clive's song.
So fine. You run all around this whole wide world. Can't get away from the blues. You can run all day, run all night. You can't get away from the blues. Oh, feeling so fine, feeling so fine.
And that's Paul Weller with the song Clive's Song.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Keeping the faith, a deadly attack at a Manchester synagogue shakes the Jewish community and our guest, an Anglican bishop who lives nearby. He tells us how he plans to support his neighbors through a dark time.
Going south has gone south. Canadians thinking of heading to the U.S. may want to check out the new messaging from Ottawa, because Global Affairs has officially and quietly updated its travel advisory for our southern neighbor.
The long law of the arms. As the federal government moves forward with its firearm buyback program, some gun owners on Cape Breton are sharing their frustrations.
Tries and tribulations. Canadian rugby star Sophie DeGoody reflects on Team Canada's incredible run at the Rugby World Cup and on tackling her own challenges.
Word of mouth, thousands of devotees descend on a small town in West Virginia to celebrate the legendary creature known as Mothman and to shine a light on its many mysteries.
And get your hose in order. A couple of firefighters in Maryland expressed their dissatisfaction with baseballs flying in from a neighboring field with professional courtesy by flooding the field with their fire hose. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that would have covered this story earlier, but we were swamped. The horror began around 9:30 this morning in northern England. Worshippers had gathered at Heaton Park Hebrew Congregation Synagogue in Manchester on Yom Kippur. Then, according to local police, a driver deliberately targeted people outside the synagogue with his car and then got out and attacked people with a knife. Two members of the Jewish community were killed. Four people were injured. The attacker was shot and killed by police, who have called this a terrorist incident. David Walker is the Bishop of Manchester. He lives near the synagogue. We reached him in Manchester earlier today.
Bishop Walker, people in Manchester are dealing with so much today. How are you doing?
Well, like everybody else, I'm shocked. The first thing we knew here, because we live only a few minutes from where the incident took place, was we started hearing police helicopters flying overhead at about 9:30, 9:40 in the morning, and that's never a good sign. So we knew something had happened, and it was fairly quick to discover that it had been an attack on a Jewish synagogue on the day of Yom Kippur, their most holy day.
You know the rabbi at the synagogue where this all happened. Have you had a chance to speak with him?
Well, I haven't today because, of course, it being Yom Kippur, he and his people have not been communicating through electronic means at all. I have been over to the site, but I haven't seen him while I've been there, and there's no other way really of contacting today. But we have put out statements. I know that he and his people will know that they're very much in our prayers and that we're standing in solidarity with them.
When you got to the site, what did you see?
Well, at that stage, I saw fire engines, police vehicles taping across the road, so we couldn't get any further. And of course, already at that stage, there were people from different media organizations beginning to mill around trying to discover what had been happening.
There were reports that the rabbi, you know, moved to protect people there. Have you heard things along those lines? Does that sound like the person you know?
That sounds like him, yes. I've heard similar stories myself at the moment, of course, because we can't check back with him directly. I don't know how true they are, but that's certainly what we've heard.
The British Prime Minister spoke today about his concerns about a rise in anti-Semitism, the potential for violence. Is that something that you and Rabbi Walker were speaking about? Was he worried about something like this happening?
On Monday evening, I held, as I do on every couple of months, a meeting here in my home and online for the leaders of faith communities across Greater Manchester, including the leaders of the Jewish community at that city region level. And one of the things we were talking about there was concerns about rising levels of anger in society, not just in Britain, but in many places, and the need for governments and all those who aspire to political power to act in ways that bring together cohesion and are not exploiting potential divisions in our society.
Yeah. You and other faith leaders, Jewish and Muslim faith leaders, interfaith dialogue is very important to you, I know, and you've been trying to get that message out. Doing that kind of work and then seeing this something like this happen, how do you deal with that?
Well, I have to keep reminding myself that the kind of people who perpetrate these atrocities, they're not the average member of any of our communities. They're people at the very extreme, often people who've had quite disrupted or troubled lives to date, who become easy prey to those who would radicalize them into this kind of behavior. But they don't represent anything more than a very tiny minority of people in our society. But of course, it only takes one person to commit an atrocity. It takes a whole society to prevent it.
There is a lot of divisive rhetoric, the political discourse, as you well know, and as you were alluding to, Bishop Walker, just a moment ago. What do you think needs to be done? What more needs to be done to quell that? Because I think some people will feel this will further inflame things, you know.
I'm sure there'll be some people at the edges who will try to use this as an excuse to sow further seeds of division, as I will continue to say, as I've said. I said after the terrorist attack in 2017, which killed 22 people and wounded hundreds more in the city centre, I keep saying again that you can't defeat hatred with hatred. You can only defeat hatred with love. And we will go on trying to love one another in our communities, even though we can heartily disagree about things, matters to do with religion, matters to do with politics. We can have serious disagreements about them, but we must hold those disagreements in good faith. We must hold them in a way that doesn't impair our relationships with one another, because our common humanity goes deeper than all of that.
How have things changed since that arena attack in 2017?
Well, it did bring us together. And I think, you know, it's a horrific thing and it should not happen anywhere. But I think in consequence, we became a stronger city, a more united city. The things when people do that try to harm us are the things that make us rally around each other and become ever more determined to strengthen the existing ties and increase our dialogue. By coincidence, in a way, it was only just before the summer break that the Jewish and Muslim leaders in the city signed a new concordat, pledging themselves to an ever closer dialogue with each other. And they invited me, the mayor, the police chief constable and other civic leaders to come and witness them signing that and to sign it along with them. And I think it's those small steps that we make that lead us on the right path, not the kind of events that happen today.
Yeah. How will you support the congregants of the synagogue, Rabbi Walker, when you are able to get in touch and as the days go forward?
We will seek to be the good neighbours that we've always tried to be. You know, I live, as I say, only a short distance away, and many of my neighbours are members of the Jewish community here. I've been seeing them on the streets even today, coming out of their synagogues or going to them for the various ceremonies as part of Yom Kippur. They've not been letting what happened prevent them from continuing to worship God in according to their tradition. And I'm a strong defender of their right to do so in our peaceful and harmonious city.
Bishop Walker, I appreciate this. Please take care.
Thank you, and you.
That was Bishop of Manchester, David Walker, in Manchester. Thank you. This evening, Canada's official travel advisory for the United States is green, meaning exercise normal security precautions. But it includes several warnings that it didn't include before. In an update last week, Global Affairs added specific caveats for any traveler with an X gender marker on their passport, and a reminder to Canadians with green cards that they can be taken away at any time. There's also new language advising Canadians with past criminal convictions that those could get them into trouble in the U.S., even if they've served their time, paid their fine, or received an all-out pardon. It's an incremental shift, but a significant one from a country that has traditionally greenlit no-holds-barred travel to its nearest neighbor. And Heather Siegel says it's prompting calls from clients. She's an immigration lawyer and founding partner of Siegel Immigration Law in Toronto. That's where we reached her.
Heather, I would imagine that up until recently, if at all, that Canadians traveling to the U.S. would even look for advisories like this, maybe if they're traveling to other countries abroad. But now that these changes have come to Canada's guidance about travel to the U.S., what kinds of phone calls have you been getting?
Well, people don't read travel advisories. You're absolutely right, especially not to the United States. But what they do read is the news. Mm-hmm. And so people are worried. What's going to happen? Am I going to get turned away? What can I expect? Would I be even arrested if I go into the United States?
They're all extraordinary questions. Heather, let's go through bit by bit some of what these updates are. In terms of what Ottawa wants, Canadians who are green card holders, people who are permanent residents of the U.S., but also Canadians, what does Ottawa want them to know?
Well, the issue with the green card holders is that if you are outside of the United States too long and then you re-enter using your green card, they may not let you back in thinking you've abandoned it. Historically, they've enacted this from time to time. I have seen people lose their green cards because they've been outside for too long. But each situation is unique, and sometimes if someone can explain what the circumstances were, maybe they were dealing with a sick relative or something, then they would be let back in. So, as I said, that hasn't changed. What has changed is the orientation to immigration and the way in which the discretion by Customs and Border Protection may be using it. And so, whereas that before was not really an issue, now it might be an issue. The second issue, which is not a legal change, but I would say it's more of a policy, an informal policy change, is that if you have a criminal record and you obtain that criminal record after you had your green card, they can initiate proceedings to take away your green card. And historically, if you were convicted of a serious crime, then you were more likely to lose your green card. But minor crimes, possession or a DUI or something, that was not really a big deal. Now, it's a much bigger deal, and they will initiate proceedings for you to lose your green card. That is different. Again, it's not the law that's changed, it's the approach that's changed.
In the United States. The Canadian advisory says even if someone has been pardoned by Canadian authorities, that pardon will not be recognized under U.S. law. That would also surprise people, I'm sure. And then on the issue of gender markers, you know, there's language, new language in the Canadian advisory about people who use X gender markers on their passports. The U.S. government, as we know, no longer accepts that. We've covered this on our show before. But what does it say to you that the Canadian government is now underlining it, acknowledging that reality in this way?
A couple of things. That America's not the historical neighbor we used to have. That we don't know what's going to happen to people who may fall into this camp. They might be denied. They might have issues if they need to show their documents in the United States for any reason. So the Canadian government is making a statement saying, watch out, it isn't the United States that we used to know. It's also making a political statement. We're navigating our tariffs with the United States. We're walking a very precarious political line. And we have to make sure that we both maintain our friendship while asserting our independence. And telling citizens of Canada that might be not always the safest and there are risks to going to the United States is a way of telling the United States, you're not the friend you used to be.
And just to remind our listeners, it's not just words in these kinds of advisories. They're also associated with colors. For example, Sweden, the Netherlands, Mexico, Italy, and Spain are all yellow. And that means travelers are told to exercise a high degree of caution, in the government's words. Despite what we've been speaking about here, and, you know, instances, as we know and have been reported widely, of Canadians being placed in ICE detention, the travel advisory, even with these changes in guidance, remains green. Should it remain green, in your view?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on a practical level, I don't think it's dangerous for Canadians to go to the United States, but...
Depends on who you are, maybe.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And that might be the message here. So as a general rule, it's okay, but there are exceptions.
And I mean, I know it's not just who you are, what you look like, and of course, how you identify, we've talked about. So I wonder what your advice is to people listening who, you know, any one of those changes and guidance that we talked about at the outset of our conversation might apply to, or maybe they're just afraid about traveling to the United States right now. What would you say to them?
Absolutely. A few things. First of all, I always recommend to go through pre-flight inspection, because you're on Canadian land. If you don't want to go, if things are happening at the border and you're feeling very uncomfortable, you can always say, you know what, I choose not to go today, and you can leave, and that's fine. If you travel at a land port of entry, of course, you're on U.S. soil. They can detain you. They can ship you off to a different state. They can do anything. So the risks are higher, and you have no rights. The second thing is, if you have an X on your passport as your gender, you should be aware that you may not get into the United States. It will depend on which officer sees you and what they decide. You have to adhere to the rules of the country that you're trying to get into. And if their rules say they don't recognize your gender, you can't change that. So you either try or you adhere to what they believe how the world exists.
Is this affecting whether you travel to the United States, just personally?
No, I mean, I've gone to the United States, and I will go back. But I can be honest, I think twice about going. It has to be a very good reason. I think if I'm going to vacation, I'll choose to go elsewhere. But there are, I mean, for work and other reasons, I sometimes need to go, in which case I will do it. But, you know, eyes wide open, you know, if you do get stopped by immigration, or if they want to take away your green card, you know, you have some rights and you should be aware of them.
Heather, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Heather Siegel is a founding partner of Siegel Immigration Law in Toronto. That's where we reached her. There's Bigfoot, of course, also known as Sasquatch, and his Himalayan brethren, the Yeti. There's the Loch Ness Monster, who insists you call her Nessie, plus any number of other so-called cryptid beings whose existence is as yet unproven. And among them sits, or flies, this guy.
Okay. It's just me.
You didn't see him, did you?
See what?
What do you do when someone comes into your office and tells you they saw this in their backyard?
My wife saw some. Drew pictures just like this. Who showed you this?
All I could see were these two red eyes.
The Mothman is a humanoid being that was sighted in and around Point Pleasant, West Virginia, a number of times in the mid-60s. In 2002, the red-eyed, black-winged creature became the subject of the horror movie The Mothman Prophecies, starring Richard Gere and Laura Linney. Neither of them played the Mothman. Its existence was first tied to a terrifying high-speed car chase near the site of a decommissioned Second World War munitions plant. And in 1967, the Mothman was linked to a tragic and very real bridge collapse that killed 46 people. But somehow, despite all of the scary lore, the mythical Mothman has also become the object of considerable affection. So much so that recently some 30,000 people descended on the roughly 4,000-person town of Point Pleasant for this year's Mothman Festival. Richard Haddam is the screenwriter behind The Mothman Prophecies. He attended the festival for the first time this year. We reached him in Pasadena, California.
Richard, you've had some time to recover from attending the festival. Have you recovered?
Yes, I have recovered. It was, you know, I mean, it's easy to recover from, you know, what's basically a, you know, 30,000 person love fest. It was a wonderful experience.
And in a town, we should mention, about 4,000 people live there. So how do they even begin to welcome that many people? And probably a lot of them in costume.
Well, they've had some experience. It's been going on for almost 25 years. And Jeff Walmsley is the gentleman who runs the Mothman Museum and also kind of, you know, oversees and runs the whole festival. And everyone shows up to have a good time. The funniest part, though, were the people lining up to be photographed with the Mothman statue. And they line up on both sides to get their pictures taken in the front. And then there's another group of people who want their pictures taken from the back because they like how Mothman's butt looks. Oh. So that's kind of who we're dealing with here.
Did you take pictures from both angles?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, it was my first time. I had to get my hands on that thing.
When did this story enter your world?
Well, it entered my world when I found the book in a bookstore in Los Angeles on March 14th, 1997. And I wanted to do a story about the supernatural, and I wanted to write a movie that was a little different than other movies. Mm-hmm. And when I found the book, it was so intriguing. And what was so interesting was that John Keel, who wrote the book, was talking about going to this town, investigating what was happening, and then the phenomenon turning its attention to him, and he became part of the story. And I loved the book and his writing so much. And I just thought it was so interesting and such a great way to get into a story about people who have experiences that cannot currently be explained. So I got in touch with him personally and wrote a script that at first I don't think he liked too much, but once they cast Richard Gere, I think his opinion changed completely.
Suddenly
he came around. He would often say, "Well, the resemblance is uncanny." So.
I'm sure Mr. Gere loved that, but Laura Linney as well. I mean, that combination, incredible. You also mentioned Jeff Walmsley, who created this festival. He was on As It Happens back in 2002, that first year of the festival, the year your film came out. Let's play for you and our listeners a bit of what he told us back then.
I was 5 years old when all that happened.
Yes.
My dad worked up at the TNT area at the National Guard Armory.
Yes.
From what my mom says, you know, he always thought they seen something. What it was, you know, he didn't have any idea, but you know, we were with everybody else that used to go up there in the car looking for and stuff like that. So.
Did you?
Yeah, just miles and miles of cars, you know, up there. They let so many cars in. It's like a public wildlife reserve.
Yes.
And they would let so many cars in to look, and then after they went, it's almost like an amusement park or something. But there's people still up there today. I mean, I get people in here every day that want to go up there and look around.
Jeff Walmsley, the organizer of the festival, you know, obviously he, like so many others, had gone looking, hoping to see Mothman. Have you? Did you? Would you?
No, no, and no.
Why?
As a younger man, I really wanted to have a supernatural experience because I thought that by having one, it would answer all my questions. And over the past 30 years, what I've discovered is that people who have these experiences, it actually doesn't answer all their questions. It multiplies them. And so I'm, as I have been for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, I'm so interested in talking to people who have had experiences that many of us don't have. And listening to the witnesses' stories and how it's changed their lives. And I'm happy to remain an armchair paranormalist.
Anyone who writes a screenplay or, you know, puts out a work of art wants people to watch it or read it or see it. Did you think, though, that one day you would be at this festival where tens of thousands of people come every single year?
Never in my wildest dreams. When, you know, and when the movie came out, and I was, I love it so much, and I'm so thrilled with the way it came out. But it was not a huge hit, and there weren't 10 sequels, so it was sort of like, well, okay, who knows what the future of the film will be. But what it's turned out to be, which is so rewarding, is that over the decades, people have discovered it and have found something in it that really strikes a chord with them. And the fact that it's then built into this thing that has really, I think, in a lot of ways helped Point Pleasant and sort of kept that town alive and flourishing, it's really been gratifying. I could not have asked for a greater legacy for that movie.
Richard, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Richard Haddam is the screenwriter of the 2002 horror movie The Mothman Prophecies and the host of the podcast Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. We reached him in Pasadena, California. And now a story that we will tell entirely through the medium of audio. Can you believe that? That's wild, eh? Don't you think that's wild? Okay. All right, I get it. I know it might have been hard to follow all the details. It probably needs another sound. Let me try again. It's not quite. I mean, look, obviously we can all hear the bat hitting the ball and the fire hose and that the story takes place in Maryland. The broad strokes are all there, of course, but I just want to connect a few more sonic dots so you get all the nuances. Let me just see here. Okay, try it now. Perfect. Perfect. Now, thanks to that one evocative soundscape, we all understand the whole unbelievable story of the baseball field at Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is next door to a fire station. And sometimes in the midst of a practice or game, a high school player hits a ball that goes astray and hits the fire station or a fire truck or one of the firefighters' personal vehicles. Who could blame these fresh-faced youths? Well, according to the charges, fire captain Christopher Riley and firefighter Alan Barnes could blame them, and did. They seethed for an unknown length of time, and, you know, as you heard in the sound effects, at 5:35 p.m. on July 17th, they erupted. They backed up a fire truck and turned on the fire hose, sending thousands of liters of water out onto the baseball diamond, flooding it and forcing the cancellation of that night's game. When two players went to complain, Captain Riley allegedly told them, "I wanted to get your attention." Now he and Mr. Barnes, both of whom are adults, I should point out, are facing three misdemeanor charges for their water tantrum. But I don't know why I'm explaining any of this. It was all in the sound effects, where we all heard the precipitating event that caused the precipitating event. Here's Andy Schauf with Fire Truck.
Truck goes screaming by, and it reminds me of that night when you said that you were coming home, and then I waited up till 4 in the morning. She says I remember, and why the fuck off? Would this be a good time to bring that up? And I am silent because I'm not sure. Sometimes I feel like I should never speak again. She takes my hand and says, "Come on, you know this one's my favorite song."
Andy Schauf with Fire Truck.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, as the federal government's buyback program for prohibited firearms kicks off in Cape Breton, some gun owners there are making it known they would like that program kicked out.
And scrumming up support. After an incredible run at the Rugby World Cup, Canadian player Sophie DeGoody says her team is feeling the love from their fans and hopes that next time they won't have to fundraise themselves to get there. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Already burning it to the ground. But now that I'm dancing in the ashes, I just want it to be old.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock is going to be Doug Danger hosting On the River. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. And we receive support from the McKnight Foundation. Comedian Rob Fairbanks, also known as Rez Reporter, performs at the New York Mills Regional Cultural Center Saturday, October 4th at 7 p.m. Tickets available online or at the door. Camp Confidence near Brainerd hosts Community Day Sunday, October 5th from noon to 5 with activities like pumpkin painting, a scavenger hunt, and more. Now back to As It Happens.
In the case of the federal government's assault-style firearm buyback program, gun owners on Cape Breton are the guinea pigs, and a lot of them are not happy about that. Today, dozens of people showed up at Cape Breton Regional Police Headquarters to voice their opposition. Since 2020, the Liberal government has banned 2,500 firearms that it considers assault-style. The government says the buyback program is voluntary, but gun owners who don't turn in their guns will have to deactivate or destroy them. Jeff McNeil is the president of the Port Morian Wildlife Association. We reached him at the protest in Sydney earlier today.
Jeff, just describe for our listeners where you are right now, the protests around you, who's there, how many people?
Well, we have a united front of firearms owners that are farmers, hunters, trappers, gun shooters, gun enthusiasts. We have gun collectors. We have a very diverse bunch of people from different cultures as well that use guns as a tool for the heritage of hunting and everything.
Yeah, why was it important for you to be there?
Well, our organization promotes the safe hunting and everything related to the outdoors. And our organization was there watching this and seeing things transpire. And at the end of the day, we said, hey, we got to stand up for what's right for us. And we're the ones being taken advantage of by the federal government.
That's a strong statement to say that you feel you're being taken advantage of. Why do you feel that way?
Because we're licensed. We're not out there causing the crime. We're not out there causing the disturbance with our firearms. We're out there to use them as tools to fill our freezers, whether it be duck hunting or deer hunting, moose hunting, bear hunting, small game hunting. The firearms that they're targeting were ones that we've purchased legally from businesses in that over time, and we use them as a tool, and overnight we become paperweight criminals by the actions of the Liberal government. There's no other ones we can point to other than them, and they're targeting the wrong individuals.
I spoke to Public Safety Minister Gary Anandasangari last week when they announced the details of this. I'll play for you and our listeners a little bit of what he said.
I do think for good law-abiding gun owners, this is a very important program because it does enable them to receive compensation for types of firearms that are now prohibited, including AR-15s. And I really think that it is a moment for them to be compensated. And if they want to keep the firearm, they can have it deactivated, and there's a compensation that they will receive for the deactivation. So I'm very comfortable in, you know, both groups of people, those who have been long calling for this and those who are legitimate law-abiding citizens who own firearms and who actually abide the law.
So Jeff, the federal government is also saying that this is not infringing on the rights of hunters or even sports shooters. It's targeting assault-style firearms. You heard what the minister said there about compensation for law-abiding gun owners. The amnesty is ongoing for another year. So what would you say to that? He's saying that this is perfectly designed for you.
The fact of the matter is, like, again, these are legal firearms that were purchased, and you guys with CBC currently are using the term assault rifle. Assault rifle is a terminology that was made up. The AR on AR-15 is armor light rifle, not assault rifle.
We're saying assault style firearms, just to be clear.
Yeah, and but you specifically, or he specifically mentioned AR.
That's, yes, that's the federal government's language.
Assault.
Yes,
but again, assault style. If you go ahead and you put a black stock on a mahogany and you change it out because you wanted to save some weight to go deer hunting, and rather than have a a 5-pound or an 8-pound rifle on your back, you lightened it up by a few pounds by putting a black stock on it. He's targeting everybody based on the fact that these firearms look scary, and they're selling that motive there that, hey, they look scary and they're this and they're that. Any gun crimes that are used with any firearms, if you actually did the research and journalism integrity aspect, you would see that many of them are from criminals and illegal purchase through illegal means, which isn't indicative or reflective of the law-abiding sports shooter, hunter, trapper that uses these tools for what has been culturally significant and ingrained in our heritage over the years.
So you own some or some of the weapons that are on this list, Jeff?
I own firearms, yes. Yeah. I own firearms, and obviously they know what firearms that me and every other law-abiding gun owner own currently.
Yeah. When this news came out, you may have heard survivors of the Polytechnique shooting.
I'm going to cut you off right there. You're comparing apples to oranges.
No. I'm just going to tell you. I'm not comparing anything. I just want to quote for you their perspective. To see what you think of, I wonder if you understand where they're coming from. They're saying, quote, most mass shooters are legal owners of the guns they used, unquote, to respond to what you were saying earlier. They feel that this is a life or death issue. So can you understand where they're coming from?
Hold on. You could go ahead and you can compare this right now to car owners and having knives in your kitchen counter, right? I know the survivors of Polytech had said that, hey, it's only a matter of time before somebody switch flips, right? Well, that could be said for everything in life, whether it be a vehicle, a knife on a kitchen counter, what have you, right? The way that it's horrific on what people do. And there's good people and then there's bad people. But again, we're vetted through the systems. We're not the ones there that are there to cause harm to people. And to label us all similar to that situation is disrespectful not only to the gun owners and the hunters of the that are taking place.
They're not talking about you specifically and other gun owners. They're talking about the weapons, and they're saying that the crimes that they've survived were committed by legal gun owners. Right. So can you just, I'm just saying, in terms of perspective or understanding or trying to meet in the middle, can you understand their concerns? What would you say to them about their concerns?
I understand their concerns, but on the same token, you get a bad apple in every bunch, which doesn't suit anybody's objective, right? And the thing with it is, if people are so worried about this aspect of legal firearms owners, it's time that we go ahead and address the concerns via doing some more background checks in depth, maybe, or something like that. But right now, we're vetted, we're trained, we're this, we're that. Mm-hmm. We can't compile everybody into the same aspect of a couple of individuals there that did the mass aspects that they have, right?
If this program does go ahead, if it doesn't flop, if it succeeds, can you imagine taking part?
We will deal with those instances as they come, right? That's the way we see that. If need be, I personally would have no choice but to, if the amnesty is up at that said time next year. Maybe we'll have a government shift. Who knows, right?
I'm glad we could speak, Jeff. Thank you for this.
So I hope I've answered that in the best aspects. And I truly get where you're coming from with the wrongful scenarios of people on what they've done, right, in the past. But many of the firearms statistics, honestly, compact more of the illegal aspect than the legal aspect as one under gun crime, statistically. And it does not give accurate numbers across the board as to the criminal aspect. Because if you look at the criminal aspects that are gun banging, drug dealing with guns, the whole nine yards, they are the ones that are the issue. But statistically speaking, we're all lumped into this whole big metrics that is currently at government's disposal to use against us.
Jeff, I appreciate this. Thank you.
I hope, like I said, that answers everything to the best of my abilities for you guys.
We wanted to get your perspective, and I'm really glad we did. Thank you. So, I mean it.
Anyway,
thank you.
I hope that works.
Take care.
Bye now.
We reached Jeff McNeil in Sydney, Nova Scotia. The international flotilla carrying aid and hundreds of civilians and parliamentarians from 44 countries, including Canada, has been intercepted by Israel in international waters. As we told you earlier this week, the Global Samud flotilla was the largest yet to try to break the blockade. It appears one boat did succeed. A boat named Makino reportedly made it into Palestinian waters before contact with that vessel was lost. It's the first time since Israel imposed the blockade that anyone has made it that far. Videos from the boats that were intercepted show Israeli ships spraying them with water cannons before soldiers boarded and detained people. Israel says it was enforcing a legal blockade and that it will now deport the activists back to Europe. Already, protests have erupted in many European cities, and another flotilla is on its way. Here are Newfoundlanders Nikita Stapleton and Sadie Meese speaking aboard the vessel the Conscience near Greece.
Yeah, we're feeling okay. I mean, that was definitely something that, unfortunately, as wrong as it is, it was very much something that was anticipated, expected. We've seen the extreme violence of Israel over the last 2 years, long before that as well. So it's something that was anticipated. It was something that was discussed before we embarked on this particular vessel, knowing that the Samud was moving ahead of us, that we would be probably witnessing what happened to them as we were continuing our journey towards Gaza. So yeah, we're definitely concerned by it, but not swayed in what we're doing about in any way. I think it's really important to challenge the idea that this mission is inherently risky or dangerous. It certainly is, but it doesn't have to be. It shouldn't be, because as Sadie pointed out, what we're doing is on the right side of international law. We have a right to engage in this activity. Palestinians have a right to receive people at their shores. And Israel is acting inappropriately and in violation of international law when they intercept these vessels and they attack these vessels. And so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
So the Conscience is primarily a mission concerned with medics and journalists, so doctors and journalists, because Israel has been deliberately targeting doctors and journalists in Palestine, killing them, abducting them, disappearing them, torturing them, etc., which is a violation of international law and cruel and inhumane. And so we are bringing journalists and doctors who are standing in solidarity with their comrades and colleagues, as well as some other, you know, medical supplies, aid, etc. But we really want to highlight the way that Israel has been targeting doctors, journalists, and people delivering humanitarian aid.
Canadians Sadie Meese and Nikita Stapleton speaking with CBC News Network from aboard the Conscience, a boat that's part of another flotilla hoping to reach Gaza. Israel has continuously denied that it targets doctors and journalists in Gaza.
New Zealand 19, Canada are going to the gold medal Rugby World Cup final next Saturday at Twickenham in front of 82,000 people.
The moment the Canadian women's rugby team secured their spot in the World Cup final for the first time since 2014. And even though last Saturday's final didn't go as they'd hoped, they lost to England 33-13, it was a historic moment because in order to get there, they had to work hard on and off the pitch. As player Sophie DeGoody told Neil back in March, Canada's athletes are considered amateurs. So to make it to the World Cup, they launched a fundraiser hoping to raise $1 million. Sophie DeGoody is the recently crowned World Rugby Women's Player of the Year. We reached her in Lagos, Portugal.
Sophie, first of all, congratulations on the new title.
Thank you so much.
We are reaching you in Portugal, as our listeners heard. Is this a bit of a rest after an incredible run?
Yeah, just we have a couple weeks off before we have to start our club season. So figured we're already over in England, might as well just hop over to Europe. So spending a week in Portugal, and then I'll head back and start to fine tune again.
Yes, that sounds like a smart strategy. And you know about strategies, certainly. You know, obviously, for you and your teammates, the final wasn't the outcome you wanted in the end. But to reach that point, to play in front of, you know, more than 80,000 people, I believe the largest crowd in the history of women's rugby. What are the memories swirling around in your mind as you, you know, try to relax in Portugal?
Yeah. I think, as you said, incredible. This was actually the second most attended Rugby World Cup final ever. That's including the men's. So most attended women's and second most attended ever, with I think 81,800 something fans. So it was an incredible atmosphere. There was a lot of red and white in the stands, unfortunately, mostly for England. But it was pretty unbelievable. I think there's a lot of disappointment still associated with the feeling. But when you step back and give perspective, it was an incredible day.
Yeah, I'm glad you're starting to try to step back and get that perspective, because your fans are certainly thrilled for all of you and excited to see more. Does it feel like, you know, being named World Rugby Women's Player of the Year, the run that you've had so far, did it feel like a turning point for you personally in your career?
I think this whole past year coming back from ACL injury has been a really trying time. I used to do interviews and such, and I'd have to come up with some adversity to make the speech interesting.
Oh.
And now I feel like I've really gone through some challenge, and it's really given me a lot of perspective around how lucky we are to play this sport. And so I feel very fortunate coming back, and it's given me a real reinvigoration, and hopefully can be a turning point into the next phase of my career.
The fans who couldn't be in the stands, Team Canada fans, what kind of support were they sending your way?
All sorts of support. It's been incredible. We've had so many messages coming in, so many that we had to kind of, I guess, turn it off for a little bit so that we could really focus on the tournament. But now, gone back into my social media and stuff, and it's incredible to see lots of friends and family, but also so many new rugby fans. And that's what's really exciting, because I think this sport has the potential to really explode in Canada if we can just introduce it to Canadians. And I think this World Cup has been really important in that step.
Yeah, and quite an introduction. If people weren't aware already, we did speak with you back in March, our listeners may remember, and your team was making the difficult decision to start a fundraiser, hoping to raise $1 million to help get all of you to the World Cup. In the end, how much were you able to raise?
Oh, I don't know the final number in the end, but I am pretty sure we reached our goal, and it's taken a real load of stress off our backs as players and team management to just be able to focus on knowing that we would have the time together that we needed to be able to prepare properly for the World Cup. And I think you saw it show in our performances. I think we hit the ground running because our build up to the World Cup was properly funded as much as we could be.
Do you think that the next, you know, when we talk about World Cup 2029, that you and your teammates will be back trying to make a pitch, trying to, you know, raise money on your own? Or do you think in these next few years that things will change?
I certainly hope not. I think at our last World Cup in New Zealand, it was 3 years ago because of the COVID delay. Mm-hmm. We created a bit of momentum. We made a good run to the semifinals, and it felt like there was a buzz about the game. And then after a couple of weeks, it really died off. And then we found ourselves looking to fundraise to improve our budget for this World Cup. And what I would love is that the momentum we've created at this World Cup carries through into investments, so that we don't have to try to do it ourselves with the support of Rugby Canada. Obviously, Rugby Canada did a lot of the legwork, but the reality is that we're just a small sport in Canada. So I would love for this momentum from this World Cup to really be a TSN turning point for us so that we can get the investment into our sport and the sponsorships necessary to be able to compete at the next World Cup.
When we last spoke, I also remember you talked about, you know, you're sort of pitching to Canadians saying we are this whole thing is so in line with what it is to be Canadian. You know, we're hardworking, we're humble. You said we just want to go chill and have a beer on the porch and kick our feet back at the end of the day. Do you think that people got that message and understand that connection now after watching what you and your teammates did at this last World Cup?
I hope so. I think they can understand the grind that we've been through as players, and I think they can see how much effort we put out on the pitch, how much we support each other. I mean, rugby's a physical sport, so you're literally putting your body on the line for your teammates. That creates a really special bond and a really special community that I think resonates with a lot of Canadians. So I hope that new Canadians to the sport were able to see that and to get behind both the grind that we do on field and the fun, loving community that we have off field. And I think you could see that hopefully through your TV screens, but also through social media, et cetera, with our players. And it's a really incredible group of women. And hopefully we've introduced the sport to more Canadians so that they can be exposed to the Canadian rugby community that we have.
Well, Sophie, congratulations again, and thanks for taking time away from your break. Enjoy the rest.
Thank you so much.
Sophie DeGoody is a member of the Canadian women's rugby team. We reached her in Lagos, Portugal. It's a debate that cuts to the heart of Catholic politics in the U.S., and this week Pope Leo made his position clear. He was asked about a decision by Cardinal Blaise Cupich, the Archbishop of Chicago, to honor Democratic Senator Dick Durbin for his decades of work on immigration, despite his support for abortion rights. After backlash from some bishops, Senator Durbin declined the award. Here's how Pope Leo responded.
I understand the difficulty and the tensions, but I think, as I myself have spoken in the past, it's important to look at many issues that are related to what is the teaching of the church. Someone who says I'm against abortion but says I'm in favor of the death penalty is not really pro-life. So someone who says that I'm against abortion but I'm in agreement with the inhuman treatment of immigrants who are in the United States, I don't know if that's pro-life. So they're very complex issues. I don't know if anyone has all the truth on them, but I would ask first and foremost that there be greater respect for one another and that we search together, both as human beings, in that case as American citizens or citizens of the state of Illinois, as well as Catholics, to say we need to, you know, really look closely at all of these ethical issues and to find the way forward as church. Church teaching on each one of those issues is very clear.
Pope Leo speaking to journalists in Castel Gandolfo, Italy.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.